Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And this week, England is back in lockdown. The Chancellor's shaken the magic money tree. The Bank of England prints more of it. US stocks are up. Donald Trump is down, but not yet out. It's been a quiet week and all, actually. And we have a comprehensive guide to surviving lockdown Mark II. Take a look at what will happen to the property market after the government decided to keep the doors open this time round. And should you even bother attempting to get your money back from Ryanair? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, what do we care? We'll start at this side of the pond, shall we? And here we are again. Pubs, restaurants, gyms, all closed in England. Toilet paper flying from the shelves. But lockdown Mark II has a different flavour this time, perhaps. The property market will stay open, as will construction, schools and unis, dentists, optometrists and Costa Coffee. Other coffee chains are available. Finance journalists have been rewriting, updating all their articles about the Chancellor's financial support measures, as they do keep changing. One thing that will not change is that this is not good news for the economy. So let's run through some of that now. But firstly, welcome, Lee, to you first. How's lockdown Mark II, lockdown 2.0, whatever we want to call it nowadays? How's it treating you? Have you signed up to any courses, changes to your working pattern, life generally? Or are you just sort of a bit used to it now?
I'm calling this lockdown light, Georgie. The reason why I'm calling it lockdown light is I was at the independent coffee shop the day before the lockdown, and the person serving the coffee said to me, "Have a good lockdown." And I said, "That's quite weird, isn't it? It's almost like wishing someone a Merry Christmas."
You said, bring special cups out for a couple of coloured cups for it, like Starbucks do, you know.
She said, we will be open for the rest of the month. And that's the reason why I say that. I say it in jest. There is, of course, another lockdown. But I would say this time round, compared to the last time, more shops and things appear to be open than round one of lockdown. So what am I doing? I wish I had time to do a course and learn a language or something like that, Georgie. But when you're also a full-time dad, all it's going to involve me is pitching in with my two-year-old daughter, who at the beginning of last lockdown learned to walk. This time around, at the beginning of lockdown, is just running rings around us. I'm loving spending more time with her, Georgie, if I'm being honest. Yeah. Simon and I were back in the office through summer, coming in 3 days a week. We're now obviously back working from home again. But we've always recorded this podcast on a Friday at home anyway. So there'll be no change to the podcast because we haven't been going in on Fridays at all. So
that is good to know. Simon, for yourself, any courses?
Oh, yeah, I've signed up to about six. I'm doing hedge laying, basket weaving.
Yeah, you didn't do that in the first one, Simon.
Slacker. Pizza chefing. Okay. And I'm learning Esperanto in the spirit of bringing the world together with a common language. No, I haven't signed up to any courses. No. Fortunately, my children are still at school, though. I'll say that much. I don't know. I read all these stories about all these people talking about, you know, oh, well, you know, once you've completed Netflix, it's time to really do something with your lockdown. Like, who are these people? Yeah. Where do they get the time on their hands? This is not a scenario that I recognise. You know, last time round, we have never been busier than we were at work. And then chucked into the mix was the fact that the government, in its wisdom, decided that children needed 4.5 months not at school, but required homeschooling, which fortunately the burden of that didn't really fall to me. It fell to my wife. But even just sort of helping out a little bit where you can, there is no time in the day. And to be honest, as Lee said, the last week or so, we've been back working from home full time. But This Is Money. I was personally enjoying going into the office and seeing people, and we were all very keen to continue doing it, but it just wasn't going to work out practically. But yeah, I don't really see where I've got getting any extra time. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I start work, and then by the time I finish work, it's knocking on the door at 7 o'clock. My kids are home. I go to see my kids for a bit, dinner time, bath time, and then you get to sit down and maybe watch an hour of TV. And you know, my wife goes to bed. I do some reading, and then you wake up again, and it's Groundhog Day. I don't know when I'm going to get the time to learn that basket weaving Esperanto. I mean, I could do the Esperanto late in the evenings, I guess.
I think this has highlighted a couple of things. I'm the same. We're all finance journalists, so time has probably never been busier. Everybody's moving online. So if I ever did things like events, everything is now online. My schedule is a lot busier, but I imagine for a lot of people, that's not the case. So it sounds as though here we are smug saying, well, we've got so much work to do. And there's lots of people that won't have a lot of work and stuff to do. Where I I guess, get a bit upset with people saying, oh, just do this course and do that, is if you are someone who's been on furlough or you've lost your job or something, while you know, look, it's going to be over, you know, you will get another job, at that moment you feel bloody awful. You don't want to do basket sodding, weaving and banana loaf, but it is a different scenario for lots of different people, I think.
No, I think there's a very good point there, and I apologise to anybody listening to this who has lost their job or is furloughed and actually would much prefer to be working rather than furloughed, because it's all very well people saying, oh, well, it'd be nice to have some more time, but then when you have enforced time on your hands, that often turns out to be not the most fun to have some time on your hands, and you're worried about the future and you're worried about money and things like that. So apologies to anybody in that position. I wasn't directly referring to you. I was referring to this columnists and Twitterati and things that you read who are all still theoretically gainfully employed whilst humble bragging about the things that they've been doing in lockdown.
Exactly.
Maybe it'd be different this time around. I was, and this is not a visual medium, so obviously our listeners can't have got this, but when Lee was saying, I'm calling it lockdown light, I was putting my finger to my lips and miming, shushing him, saying, don't do that. Don't let the government hear. They'll make it even worse. But there is a good point there, and we're going to talk about this in a second rather than just gabbling on about what we are or aren't doing, is that there's a lot more of the economy open this time round from the off, whereas last time round, everything pretty much was totally shut from the off, and then it edged open little bit by little bit.
Well, this is what I was sort of leading up to. One, I think psychologically, as frustrating as it is, we're all a bit more prepared for it this time. We've done it before. But also, this is different. And Lee, I had the same situation where I mentioned Costa, because I was astonished that they were. Holland and Barrett as well. All these sorts of shops that I was expecting. Are these essential? I mean, is coffee essential? I mean, to me it is. But
I think this is different. I think the reason that I feel like it's slightly different this time around is that a lot of these businesses, of course, had to close in March, April, May, June. They kind of then reopened in the summer. They've invested money into making their premises COVID secure. You know, they've got, they're more prepared this time, Georgie, I think is what I'm trying to say. And if they've been allowed to stay open, they can stay open with all of these, you know, signage already in place, you know, all of the sanitizer, all of those kind of things. And, you know, some key services are open this time that weren't around last time. So you can get an optician's appointment. You can go to the dentist, you know, because these things are important. You know, your dental health, you know, having an eye test can pick up on all sorts of health issues, for example. So some of these things actually being open this time and having all of the equipment and all of the processes in place is what I mean by lockdown light, as in there are places that are way more, you know, you go down a high street, there's more things open than there was last time around.
Yeah, if you're a pub landlord, you're swearing at us right now. But yeah, obviously there is more open. But Lee, to that end then, one might question, we had some changes from the Chancellor. I won't run through how it's all changed, but basically furlough has been extended now for 5 more months at, you know, almost its best rate. So 80% paid by the government, but the employer has to pay national insurance and pension contributions around 5%. I think they said it was about £70 a month that they would have to pay. So there's some skin in the game from employers this time round. But you might question if this is lighter and we're expecting perhaps measures to ease, and Boris Johnson is very adamant we will have Christmas, why bring in blanket furlough when it is so, so cripplingly expensive? 41 billion, I think, up till October.
Well, that's a good question, Georgie. And actually, you know, at the end of the day, the Chancellor has seemingly come up with other schemes, other plans. This winter economy plan just ripped up and sort of like it's gone back to the beginning. It's like all of these different job retention schemes and all these things have sort of been ripped up, and now we're just going back to the original one. And the question has been asked, there's a couple of factors at play here. The question has been asked, if this has been extended to March, inevitably, are we looking at a longer extended lockdown? Or will we be looking come December, January, February, tier lockdowns again? So regionalised ones. And that's the kind of thing that it's played fear. The first thing, I got some messages from some friends saying, I've seen furloughs being extended till March. Does that mean we're going to be locked down till March? And of course, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know if there's going to be Christmas. as in, you know, will we be able to mix households or six people get together inside a household? Might depend on whereabouts in the country you're living. You know, all of these decisions aren't easy to make. The one thing that I always felt in the summer is that we kind of, and I'm sure I mentioned this on the podcast before, you know, it kind of felt like things were sort of getting back to normal a little bit. You know, we were kind of getting out there doing things. And of course, it was the summer. So things like flus and colds, and then of course, coronavirus, aren't spread around as easily because we're not indoors as much. You know, we're not mingling as much on public transport, in shops, in here, there and everywhere, right? It was always kind of inevitable, I guess, that the cases were probably going to rise in the winter, and a lot of people kind of probably braced themselves for that and were kind of prepared for that. This furlough scheme extension for some people will be a huge lifeline. The Treasury is saying it's going to cost an additional £27.5 billion. The Resolution Foundation think it's going to be more like £31 billion. But what does it matter? A couple of billion pounds now, I mean, that just feels like nothing, does it? And the big question will be, how do we pay for all of this? You know, in the future, what kind of tax rises are we looking at? What kind of austerity measures are we looking at? You know, those kind of questions are currently unanswered. And I think it's making people quite nervy. And you think by March, it would have been one full year of furlough. And of course, the other thing, George, is people that have been made redundant since between this new scheme coming out and furlough being extended and all these different things, people will probably be a bit peeved if they've lost their job and actually it turned out they could have been furloughed for a little bit longer.
Yeah, you can also, though, be brought back from redundancy or re-employed, as you could on the last iteration of the scheme or before it was extended. You can also do the same now. But people might argue, Simon, that are those jobs really viable? If that person has been deemed to be, and I don't like using this expression, so forgive me, surplus to requirements, not needed at that place of employment, that job is not useful anymore. So that person will be brought back to give money. Amazing for that person, absolutely, to be brought back to have some guaranteed income. But is there not argument that perhaps money should be better spent perhaps in more skills training, for example?
Maybe, yes. And the cost of furlough is hugely controversial. The theory behind it is that it staves off the inevitable job losses. And first time round, furlough happens, loads of businesses can't, first time round, lockdown happens, loads of businesses can't operate. Lots of businesses saw the furlough scheme, thought, right, okay, we need to dramatically cut our costs. They put their staff on furlough. Then they discovered that actually, that they were doing more work than they thought. So you've got the working from home stuff, which actually the country adapted to much quicker than people thought they would do. And has largely been a success. There's definitely a lot of value in going into the office and seeing people for office workers. And there's lots of people who can't work from home. But on a broad level, that was a success. It worked quickly. So businesses end up being probably being busier than they thought they would. Mm-hmm. Once lockdown eased a little bit and other people could go back to work, the sort of consumer economy proved to be more resilient than people thought. He had a big boom in online shopping. There's some really interesting charts in the Bank of England report yesterday saying this sudden huge spike in online shopping and also the things that people went out and bought. And whilst there's, you know, there's two sides to the ledger, there's one side that shows stuff that people aren't spending on, transport, travel, all that kind of stuff. And there's another side showing that what people are spending more on. So companies who got surprised by that brought their staff back off furlough. They needed more stuff. They needed the staff back. But you had the industries that were like most heavily impacted by this, very, very heavily furloughing workers, retailers, the hospitality industry, and so on. The rhetoric over summer changed to let's try and get some of those people back to work as we gradually reopen the economy. And let's try and make this about viable jobs. Let's not make this about just keeping jobs that are unviable in the future on the life support machine. That rhetoric has now changed again. We've gone back to pretty much the old, let's just try and keep these jobs, keep these people employed in these jobs while we get through this until these places can reopen again. And that's due to the fact that you've again got a big chunk of the economy, retailers, hospitality, gyms, so on, mm-hmm. being told you have to shut your doors. Now, what's an observable phenomenon is that once those places are allowed to open their doors again, the customers seem to come back. I mean, it surprised everyone quite how eager people were to get back out, you know, eating, drinking, shopping, doing stuff over summer, because people thought that they would be much more likely to continue to hide away. That was the thing behind Eat Out to Help Out, was because to try and get over that, you know, people being reluctant to go out. Actually, I think people proved to be less reluctant to go out than you'd think. And you'd think that next time round, that might again be the case. Obviously, that depends on whether the second wave is worse than the first wave and all these things like that. But psychologically speaking, this is very different to March and April. March and April, everybody was very, very scared. This was a totally new scenario. It was, to use the word of the months back then, unprecedented. And so people did stay at home. They didn't go out anywhere. They very reluctantly went to the supermarket and B&Q. But they did kind of, there was a lot more stay at home stuff. This time around, you know, it's only the first couple of days, but you're not noticing that. You're not noticing the same attitude. People are still out and about. As you said, there's more stuff open. You know, think how long it took for the coffee shops to reopen. Think how long it took for the pubs to start doing takeaway pints and things like that last time around. This time around, the pubs were told they couldn't do takeaway pints. And there was a big backlash against it. And now they're going to do takeaway pints. And that reflects not just the business's attitude, but also the attitude of their customers. So you'd have to see a big about turn for it to be the case that when we finally manage to reopen the bits of the economy, we're just shut for the second time in a year, that the customers don't come back. So maybe it's the right thing to do to keep those people in those jobs. But that said, there is possibly, you know, a dramatic restructuring of stuff going on, like retail and stuff behind the scenes, that means that not all of those jobs will be there. But we've seen wave after wave of job losses from big companies. John Lewis cutting 1,500 people recently, in his head office.
Might have surprised a lot of people.
Sainsbury's, that's to do with the pulling Argos into the Sainsbury's network. Lloyd's this week. Those are just the ones this week. Lloyd's this week. And the Bank of England expects unemployment to peak at about 7.75%. Wonderfully precise figure. Yeah. In the middle of next year, and then start to tail away again. So it expects the job losses to keep on coming. Rishi's trying to do everything he can to stop that. And before we move on from job support schemes and everything like that, which we've talked about endlessly on this podcast in recent months, I would just like to say that the one thing he has done is extended the support for the self-employed. The one thing he hasn't done is given any help whatsoever to the people who are self-employed who haven't had any help at all. So if you've earned more than £50,000 in trading profits, which it's important to note, as a sole trader, you will have paid tax on in full in previous years, you still get absolutely nada. Whereas if you earn £50,000 and are furloughed, you get a maximum of £2,500 a month. And I think that's wrong. But where I think it's also wrong for those people, for the limited company directors, grey area as to whether they're self-employed, but effectively they're part of the self-employed workforce, freelancers, recently self-employed, all that kind of stuff, is we're now at a point where those people could reasonably demonstrate if their income has crashed since March. Okay? Maybe that couldn't happen in May or June. It'd be too difficult to do. But if you are one of those people, you could now quite easily demonstrate and say, look, here you go. Here's the figures. I've lost 80% of my income, 90% of my income, all of my income. And so why are we not helping those people when we are literally throwing money at the wall?
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be that he's got the self-employment scheme in operation. That's been made more generous. But again, it's more generous for those who are eligible for it. And there's about over 2 million, I think, who aren't.
I was just going to say one other thing, actually, which is that I feel really, really sorry for all the businesses who have been forced to close, who have spent huge amounts of money in preparing themselves to reopen and make themselves COVID secure. I mean, the hospitality industry has really gone above and beyond in many places in trying to do that. You've also seen it in places like gyms and in some of the shops that you go into and stuff. I understand that, obviously, you know, the lockdown is being done for a reason, and there's many different arguments for and against that. But I would just like to extend my sympathy to anybody in that position who has gone out there, invested their time, their savings, and their hopes into getting a business ready to operate in this new world, only to be told to shut. Yeah. I really, really feel for you.
All I will say in that, and I agree with you and extend that sympathy, but I imagine this new world we talk about will be in operation for some time yet. So I'm not sure that plastic screens are going anywhere.
But unfortunately, you know, there's some of those businesses might not be.
Oh, yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is the problem.
Yeah,
you know, it's like this could be the difference between some businesses out there, you know, folding or not, and people losing their life savings and all the time and effort they've invested into it. So I wish them all luck.
Absolutely, Simon. Lee, I did want to ask you, though, because you mentioned it about how we're going to pay for it. Don't worry, I'm not going to put you on the spot here and give me a detailed plan about how this is all going to be funded. But the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee this week voted unanimously to expand its QE programme, $895 billion. It also held rates at a historic low of 0.1%. We'll get on that in a second. But what will all this do to the economy and the QE program and all this sort of money sloshing around?
It's a £1 trillion almost of helicopter cash just sort of flown in, which actually dwarfs what was done in the financial crisis. And I mean, there's been all of these talks, all of the chatter in the last kind of month or two about negative rates, and that's still not off the table, I would say, Georgia. There's still kind of talks, you know, even before the end of the year that might potentially happen. But this is just a way of trying to prop up the economy. I mean, to be honest with you, Simon will be much better explaining this than me on the podcast. I might turn it over to him. Go on, Simon, you give us a better explanation. You did a big old piece on this yesterday.
Well, everybody was watching out for negative interest rates. We weren't expecting them to arrive. I mean, there's some real debate as to whether the negative interest rates has any point in them whatsoever. Do they dent confidence more than they boost the desire of or the impetus for banks to lend? And however cheap you make the money at the moment, do people and businesses really want to borrow it other than people sinking it into the ever-rising housing market in this country, which is not necessarily a desirable effect? And then the Bank of England decision was moved forward from midday to 7, the announcement, and everyone went, whoo, negative rates are coming, pre-stock market open. And then the Bank of England announcement said, we're doing this in order to not clash with Rishi delivering his statement. But so negative rates didn't arrive, but £150 billion more QE did. So quantitative easing involves the Bank of England creating money, printing money in layman's terms, and injecting it into the financial system by buying government bonds. It buys UK government bonds. Now, just to put that into context, £150 billion, that has taken the total of QE done of Bank of England purchases of government bonds in billion from £745 billion to £875 billion. But we have done more QE since March than we did after the financial crisis. So up until March, QE stood at £435 billion that we'd done. It now stands at £875 billion. We've done an extra £440 billion. We are shaking the magic money tree like there is no tomorrow. The Bank of England now owns, it has to be an estimate on this because the slightly conflicting figures, between a third and a half of all existing UK government debt. I mean, that is absolutely astonishing. The government also now has pretty much an unlimited overdraft with the Bank of England, which effectively means that the Bank of England is kind of sort of financing the government's spending in the crisis. It's not quite monetary financing, which is an iffy issue. And the Bank of England said, oh, no, we're not doing monetary financing. But to a lot of people, it looks a little bit like we're printing money to fund government spending. In normal times, this would be a major issue for a country's credibility. We're thinking kind of a hyperinflation scenarios. We're thinking, you know, Weimar Republic, Germany, Zimbabwe, that kind of thing. These aren't normal times. Everyone's up to these ruses. So nobody's paying attention. As long as you're keeping your economy afloat, nobody really cares. And actually, people just want the cheap money to keep on coming. Whether there's going to be an effect of this down the line of creating all this money at the stroke of a keyboard and lobbing it into the economy, and whether it is actually going more directly into the economy now because extra government borrowing is then being spent on furlough, which involves directly handing money to people, And this could be heavily inflationary down the line. We don't know. But inflation's at 0.5%, not expected to get above the 2% target for a while. GDP absolutely nosedived, rebounded through summer, started to slow. We haven't had the third quarter estimates in, but something really dramatically bad would have had to have happened in September for us not to get a quarter of growth, which takes us out of recession. Bank of England now forecasts a contraction in the last 3 months of the year. So the economy is going to shrink by 2%. You need two quarters of negative growth, i.e. shrinking in a row, to go back into a recession. Bank of England says we'll get growth back at the start of 2021. So we'll just about avoid that double dip recession that we're flirting with. But that is entirely predicated on lockdown finishing when it's meant to finish. If lockdown doesn't finish when it's meant to finish, and that's the English lockdown, I'm aware there are Welsh ones, Northern Irish ones, and Scottish versions. The English economy is the biggest one of the four, but we will probably go back into recession. You know, we might just dodge it, we might not. There'll definitely be some will they, won't they stuff. As I said earlier, unemployment predicted to peak middle of next year. Some really interesting stuff in there about the stuff that people have spent more on and less on. So spending, annual growth in spending in selected categories. Food and drink services, slightly down. Fuel, more down. Hotels and accommodation, down even more. Entertainment, down even more. Travel, unsurprisingly, down 60% annually while spend. I mean, I suppose maybe it's impressive that we've managed to actually spend the rest of the money we've been spending. Interestingly, though, what are we spending more on? Electronics, up 20%. Groceries, up just over 20%. Home improvements and DIY, up 30%. Furniture, 40% more spending, annual spending on furniture. You know, as Britain basically splashes out a bit in lockdown and goes, right, well, if I'm going to have to stay at home, I'll make home a bit better. And the percentage of online retail sales rocketed from 20% to nearly 35% before slipping back a bit, obviously, as the economy reopened. Consumer confidence nosedived, rebounded a bit, has fallen again. Business confidence much more badly affected. Businesses are very reluctant to invest. And then we have to just quickly mention the housing market. Talk about a V-shaped recovery. You want a V-shaped recovery, housing transactions and mortgage approvals for house purchase fall off a cliff and then rebound straight back up to the level that they were at. House price indices showing house prices rising substantially. Halifax told us this morning they're up 7.5% a year. That's £18,000 on the average house since last October. If you just cast your mind back to the stuff that's happened since last October, we've had the no-deal Brexit worries, a new prime minister, the Boris bounce, which lasted about 27 seconds, the coronavirus panic, the lockdown, the sort of easing of the freezing of the property market, the easing of lockdown, the return of, well, tears, fears, and lockdown. And house prices are still up nearly £18,000 in a year. But, you know, there's some trouble in the trouble at the mill there. Mortgage crunch for first time buyers is pretty bad. If you look at the figures for 90% mortgages in that Bank of England report, that's a nasty looking chart, that is. And the stamp duty holiday finishes at the end of March. There's people chasing that theoretical £15,000 saving on a £500,000 house. Probably a false economy because they're probably going to end up spending more in order to do so. Once that holiday goes, if that holiday goes, it's expected to be a slump in activity. And also, to be honest, from what I'm seeing, it's already happening. I've got a lot of property alerts set up from Rightmove and stuff, just, you know, keeping an eye on the market and just because I'm nosy Parker and obsessed with property and house prices and things like that. I'm seeing a lot of reduced labels going onto properties that are on the market and a lot of properties coming back onto the market that had gone under offer. I think we can call the end of the property mini boom now.
Ooh, bold statement.
You might see house price inflation continue to rise slightly on some of the indices because obviously it's not a perfect relationship between that but what you're seeing in the market. But I think mini property boom is done. Maybe it has even been done for a couple of weeks or a month now.
Lee, what do you reckon? The government made a point this time round that the housing market should keep going, that estate agents can do viewings. moves will go ahead. Do you agree, perhaps, with Simon? Do you agree with some of the other experts that despite this, that mini boom for house prices could stall?
I think house prices are just so ingrained in the British psyche that when you see house prices ticking along and going higher, everyone thinks, you know, kind of things are ticking along pretty well. Of course, when lockdown began and the whole property market shut down, it was kind of difficult for indices to keep going and telling us what the value of homes were collectively in Britain because all the data sort of collapsed and we didn't quite know. And then, of course, when the property market reopened, there was kind of talks of, you know, house prices were going to completely collapse and fall off a cliff. And then we had stamp duty holiday, which just put a firework, you know, into the market and just saw people go, cool, let's get a move done. Let's do this, right? And it just really got people going. There was already a backlog of people wanting to move anyway that might have had their property move put on hold because of the pandemic. And it just, we've had a couple of months, I think, of absolute craziness in the property market. But I think what the nail on the head there is that Halifax is saying that the average home has gone up 16 grand in a year. And then you have to factor in what you might be saving on your stamp duty. And it, as Simon says, it just feels like a bit of a false economy. And what happens when that stamp duty holiday ends is probably going to be the more interesting part. Because if it just stops on that date, we could then start to see, you would think, property inflation begin to fall and probably fall a bit harder than it would have done because house prices have gone up 7.5% in a year, according to Halifax. So there's all sorts of factors at play in the property market. This time around, there's a lot of people, obviously, in the industry that are far happier that things like valuations can be done, viewings
can be done. I mean, what technically can you do now? What is it going to look like? I mean, can you get surveyors around? What's it going to
be? Yeah, as long as all the measures are in place. So as long as all the rules, you know, 2 meters apart and having face coverings and all that kind of thing. I think the government this time around are keen on not completely putting a block on the market. And if they did, they'd probably be accused of being a bit ridiculous, really, because of the stamp duty holiday. You know, bringing out a stamp duty holiday and then for a whole month putting a pause on the property market. Well, what would be the point of that? And then, of course, if lockdown does finish at the beginning of December as stated, people then have a very short amount of time to get property viewings in, get an offer accepted and start going down the road with buying a house, because buying a house takes months. It's not like you can put an offer on a house in March 2021, get it over the line in time to get your stamp duty holiday. You know, we're being warned that they've got about a month to go if they want to take advantage of the stamp duty holiday, really. And of course, we've got a month of lockdown. And what and you've got to factor in all the other things, you know, banks, building societies have been swamped with mortgage requests. A lot of them are working from home staff, so it becomes more difficult, more of a process to get that mortgage over the line. We've got all of solicitors and all of those kind of things that sometimes you just kind of forget about in the house buying process that takes time. I don't really understand. What I can't understand the stamp duty holiday is that if you have all this in a row and sorted, and then for whatever reason there's a slight delay and it takes you beyond that stamp duty holiday period, well, you could be looking at a £15,000 bill that you haven't factored in because you were hoping to get it over the line before the holiday ends and it just stops and falls off a cliff. So it's... I would have thought calling the mini boom over now is probably just about right. We always have a seasonal lull anyway when it comes to the festive period. Maybe that festive lull is going to be a little bit, not as much as previous, as you usually would get because of the fact that the property market was shut for so long. And the fact that people want to try and get property purchases over the line to benefit from the stamp duty holiday. So, yeah, I would say mini boom over, Georgie. And it seems to be a lot of people that have been wanting to upscale, you know, get into sort of houses, maybe 2 or 3 bedroom houses, whereas before, you know, that was seen as a sort of second step, perhaps, for people who would usually buy a flat, maybe first time round. I think that's helped push up prices because what people are after is a bit bigger and a bit more expensive than what might have been this time last year. I wouldn't be surprised to see house prices fall quite a bit next year.
Well, Simon, I know your views about stamp duty and the like, but Simon, I don't want to focus too much on this for much longer because please do go back to Simon's, I don't want to say rant, Simon, but yeah, there's certain things that you don't agree with. Self-employed schemes from Rishi Sunak and this is stamp duty and Islington Council that I don't think you have to worry about anymore as you've moved. But the column this week from you, you picked the lowest, I think, of hanging fruit to direct your ire at. Is that fair, Simon? You know, when we think it's Ryanair that you chose. I mean, what was it about Ryanair that made you want to criticise them this time round?
Yeah, you're right. And I did start off my column by saying it seems a bit stupid writing a column about poor customer service from Ryanair. Its reputation goes ahead of it, means that that sort of goes without saying. However, Ryanair has stepped up its game on customer service in recent years. About 2 or 3 years ago, it might have even been longer, time passes quickly. It went on a bit of a charm offensive for customers because I think it had decided that it being as mean to them as was possible, they might have taken that one, ridden that horse as far as that horse was going to go, and then they decided to jump horses, especially because EasyJet was being a bit nicer to customers and had started giving people allocated seats and things like that. Largely because not giving people allocated seats was delaying planes taking off as people were trying to find somewhere to sit and get their bag into an overhead locker. You know, Ryanair brought that in, started being nicer to people, a few less sneaky charges, a bit more understanding of stuff. And they'd been doing very well. And then the pandemic happened. Now, in the early days of the pandemic, obviously, a lot of flights were cancelled. People are automatically entitled to their money back if their flight is cancelled. And Ryanair seemed to be reasonably okay with the refunds. They were almost impossible to get hold of. They have always been almost impossible to get hold of. But they were processing the refunds. I think Mr. Boyce might have got a Ryanair refund, didn't you, in the early days of the pandemic? And then they sort of changed their tactic at Ryanair. And over the summer, after the government's fabled air bridges idea turned into a list of countries that you could go to, which then turned into a list of countries that you might be able to go to, but you could be playing quarantine roulette because they might take the country off at short notice. Georgie Frost knows about that one because she ended up in Spain for longer than expected. Your theory was that if you waited it out, they might put it back on the list, wasn't it?
I know, I was so optimistic, wasn't I?
Yeah, and then you still had to quarantine when you came back.
Yeah, and I got to the absolute edge of what my allowance for travel insurance, you reminded me to check that as well. It was, I think, a day. So yes, I managed to get back in time, but it was very optimistic of me thinking that, you know, 45 days wouldn't be enough.
Government brings in policy, telling people they can go on holiday, making a big fuss about how people can go on holiday. Government does not at the point when it brings in policy say, we might take these countries off at very short notice. Government pulls Spain off, which alerts people to this prospect. Now, airlines had done some pretty brisk business selling people flights in the early days of the air bridges thing, as people went, woohoo, I can go on holiday. I was one of those people who thought, woohoo, I can go on holiday. Booked myself some flights to France at the end of August. A week before we're meant to travel, France is put on the naughty list by the government. Mm. Now, this involves the FCO changing its advice to advise against all but essential travel to that country. The headlines at the time obviously focused on the two-week quarantine and the people racing back to beat quarantines and stuff like that. But there is a more important issue here in terms of travelling, which is that if you travel after the government, the FCO, has said it has advised against all but essential travel, most people will find that their travel insurance is invalid. So you will be going on holiday with no valid travel insurance. If you're going abroad in Europe, okay, you've got your EHIC and that should cover medical care at the same cost as people get it for in that country. But there's lots of other things you won't be covered for. Traveling uninsured in the middle of a pandemic, slightly risky, I would say, and not something that people would necessarily desire to do. And also you're going against the official advice of your own government. Your government is saying to you, don't go, and it's doing that for a reason. It's not doing it just because Grant Shapps wants to cause you problems on your way home. It's doing it because it thinks that is the right thing to do and it wants to limit people traveling. Ryanair decided that its tactic was to continue flying its planes because it said there were still people who had to make essential travel. There were people who were flying back to those countries and so on. And because the planes were flying and not cancelled, it said that you were not entitled to a refund. Now, some people, depending on when they booked, could change their flights for free. I could change my flights for free. I was going on holiday with my wife and my two young daughters. I contacted Ryanair and I explained that I couldn't go away now. Not I wasn't willing to, but I could not travel now because I would be taking me and my children away uninsured. If it was a week's holiday by myself, I'd be more than happy to gamble on me going away uninsured, which might be stupid, but I'm more than happy to gamble on that. Taking my kids, though, that is a little bit daft. And also, there's the whole government advice thing. You know, I would have been going against the government advice. So I said, look, I can't travel, so please could you give me a refund? I don't expect you to give it to me in cash. I'll accept vouchers, which I think is fair enough because it keeps the money in the company, okay? You're not saying to Ryanair, give me all my cash back. You're saying, just give me the vouchers. The online chat person said, we can't do that. We can't give you a refund. You can change your flights for free. I said, the thing is, I can't change my flights because your system will only let me change four return flights for four return flights. So I'd have to do it for all four of us. And the way things are, I don't really want to book flights for my kids. I book flights for me and my wife as a gamble. I don't want to book flights for my kids. So could you just give me a voucher? You know, and then effectively the only way I can spend that voucher is on Ryanair flights in the future. No. So they said, email us. She said, the only thing you can do is email. So I email. And eventually, this was before I was meant to fly. Flight classes, I hadn't changed the flights obviously, so they're gone. Eventually, more than a month later, I get an email back from Ryanair, which is just a stock email. It doesn't actually even acknowledge any of the points that I've made in my request. So I email them back and say, thanks for the reply, but no thanks. It's not really a reply. You've completely ignored everything I've said. You know, please can you give me a refund? I'll take the voucher. Da, da, da. So I got another reply back. Well, when I say another reply, it wasn't really another reply. I got the exact same email back, which I thought was impressive, even by Ryanair standards, to completely ignore everything you said once. And then you send them an email to their customer services saying you've completely ignored everything I've said, and then to reply to you with the exact same email that they'd sent you the first time around. I mean, I think that's actually a notch above what you'd get in terms of incompetence from BA or EasyJet, or willful incompetence from BA or EasyJet. So now I'm in the position of, what do? I could go to my credit card company. My credit card company might agree with me and give me the money back, or it might tell me that because the flight went and I didn't go, I'm not entitled to the money back. I think I might actually be able to claim on my travel insurance potentially, because I think my nationwide travel insurance does cover you for if the FCO changes its advice. But really, I shouldn't be claiming on either of those things. Ryanair should just give me the money back, because it's not reasonable for Ryanair to expect people to travel uninsured and against government advice. I get it. I get the problems the airline industry are having. I get that maybe they shouldn't give people cash refunds, but I do think they should just give people a voucher back, and that is the reasonable thing to do. The question is 220 quid. Do I bother?
It's a funny state of affairs. I'm going to bring our consumer champion. 220 quid is a fair amount of money. So how much stress and effort you go through to get your money back? Are these things worth it, Lee?
I think it's a question of fairness, Georgie. At the end of the day, when Simon booked those flights in August, unless Ryanair put a massive disclaimer up on that website saying, if government advice changes, just to let you know, you won't be getting your money back, or you'll get it in a form of a voucher, you can make a more informed choice as a traveller. If it's buried somewhere in terms and conditions, or it doesn't exist at all, then, you know, really, Ryanair are in the wrong. You're not going to fly somewhere where the government, your own government, is telling you not to fly to, because, A, that's not sensible. It's definitely not sensible with a family. And if it invalidates any kind of insurance that you have, I mean, that's just a worst-case scenario, isn't it? So in the travel industry, I think it's all about, during this pandemic, the companies and airlines and other bits and pieces that have treated customers fairly, who will remember that in the future, and companies that haven't.
For them, isn't it just a question of blind survival, they're probably thinking now, for some of them? I mean, they went in the greatest state. The first, would we have three airlines that went under before the coronavirus pandemic even struck?
Yeah, that's true. But then the likes of Ryanair, EasyJet, you know, were ticking along quite nicely, Georgie. I mean, I'm not going to pile into EasyJet and Ryanair here, because I've used them numerous times over the years. I think we're an incredibly lucky generation in which we get to fly around for next to nothing around Europe for less than it costs to get on a train and go a couple of hours in our own country. So I can't sit here and completely attack them. But in the same breath, I think it's just about treating customers fairly. Yes, it's about them now surviving, but there's one thing surviving, there's another thing them thriving in the future. And what happens in the future now, in the future of travel, it's just a massive, massive question mark as to when things will ever, if, you know, go back to even a slight bit of normality, because yeah. I think there's going to be a consumer shift in people going, right, I've got a week off work, I'm not going to book flights, accommodation until the day before, a couple of days before, you know, until this pandemic blows over. And a lot of people would have been burnt from companies that they probably trusted or thought that they would at least get some money back. I think the argument with this with Simon here is that he's not going, right, I've booked these flights, give me my cash back. He's saying, I will take it in the form of vouchers in which I will use in a flight for a flight in the future, in which then you produce a customer service that gets me from A to B and back from B to A. And, you know, you're happy. You might spend a bit of money on board. All of those kind of things. And then it makes you a repeat customer. I just don't think there's merit in kind of sending out stock emails. I don't think there's merit in, you know, kind of ignoring the issues that are at play. And the fact is, you know, flights should not be on sale, period, if they think that this kind of advice is going to change and they're not going to do the right thing by their customer, in my opinion.
I'm a little bit, weirdly, I find myself a little bit not more sympathetic to business than customers, of course not, but I do think this is absolutely unprecedented times. It's not about, you know, quite simply just handing people back their money. This is, you know, it's not just one person who's got a complaint and therefore, you know, this is billions and billions of pounds which could sink even the biggest of companies. And they're following what they think is actually consumer law. There is a directive that says if a flight is cancelled, they can give you your money back. If not, where's the pressure for them to make themselves financially disadvantaged?
Two things. One, I'm not asking for my money back. I'm asking for a voucher. That keeps the money in the business. If I either spend that voucher on flights...
It also takes a flight. If you take a flight later on, that takes money that would have gone to another person booking that seat.
Well, if they'd have actually, when I'd have contacted Ryanair as soon as possible before I was meant to fly, they'd have given me the voucher. They could have resold the seat, or they could have known that that seat was going to be empty, and they could have amalgamated the flight with another one, which is what the airlines have been doing an awful lot of recently. You know, and if they gave me my money back and there was an empty seat on that plane, I'll be a full seat on another plane. The money's not leaving the business. And effectively, you are not able to fly. So I think it's a good halfway house to basically say, okay, you can have a voucher. I either use the voucher and I take a Ryanair flight, or I never use the voucher, which, you know, consumer behavior, everybody knows a lot of people don't spend their vouchers. Time limit the voucher. And if people don't spend the vouchers, they lose the money and Ryanair wins. It gets cancelled. Secondly, they've just upped their game on this substantially. Michael O'Leary has said that they are going to be continuing this practice throughout November lockdown. Anybody booked onto those flights still go. They don't get their money back. Now, it's a slightly different scenario now. Previously, it was the FCO advising against all but essential travel. You'd think that would be enough. I mean, it is the government telling you not to travel. This time round, in the rules that they've made, it's pretty much illegal to go. You're not allowed to go on holiday. That's borderline illegal. I think it might be illegal. Unless you're traveling for business or a very valid reason, the government has said you are not allowed to leave the country. Yet Ryanair is saying that it still expects you to travel on its planes and it will not even give you a voucher refund if your plane takes off and you don't go on it. I mean, that ups the game. It really does.
I'm just playing devil's advocate. But anyway, look, I want to ask you before we disappear. There was a bit of brouhaha going on in the States, and I just wanted Simon to get your view about the impact that that would have on things like the markets. We've had a bit of a bounce actually in the US stock markets, but it seems remiss that, you know, we wouldn't just touch on it.
Well, as it stands, Donald Trump has escalated his erratic and unprecedented presidency with some fairly erratic and unprecedented behavior as he tries to win his four more years. Allegations of a major fraud on the US people and people stealing the election, etc., etc., etc. largely baseless as far as anyone can ascertain, unless this is a gigantic conspiracy, which I suppose it could be. He might be right. He does tend to fly off the handle with stuff, though. So, I mean, we can't say we weren't warned. He's been banging on about this for a while. He's been giving us some heavy hints that this is how he would behave in the event of a tight defeat and loss. And he hasn't lost yet. They're still counting. There's a number of states that could go either way. It looks like Joe Biden's going to win. Donald Trump has said he's going to court to try and stop himself not being president. What we said, though, the markets, well, what we said is what the markets wanted was that the markets didn't really care that much about a Trump or a Biden win. Mm-hmm. What they cared about was that the Fed kept printing. And so as long as that happened, they weren't that fussed about which one it was. Trump, more pro-business. Biden, less pro-business. But neither of them likely to massively disrupt things. Biden, if he's held back by the Senate being Republican, is less of a risk to business and the stock market continuing to rise. But the one thing we said they didn't want was a disputed result where it wasn't clear who had won, the threat of court action, months and months and months. That was what would rock markets, see massive volatility, potentially see a major slide in the stock market. So that happened and the stock market went up.
Hopefully by the time we speak next time, we will have someone in the White House. Well, it will be Donald Trump, obviously, until January anyway, but then they get a new one and we'll hopefully have an answer then, but who knows. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app, and if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Yes, Georgie Frost, 2024, make elections decisive again. You can tweet us at thisismoney, you can email us editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in reader comments. And who knows, by next week we might know who the new president's going to be.
Who knows? And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.